But the real value is not holding the deal for 5 years and selling it and doing another deal. The real value is 30 years from now, when you've got a property that's free and clear, or your debt service is just minimal on it, and it's just cash flowing like crazy, and you don't really have to do anything to the property, and your day-to-day is like playing golf or sailing or whatever it is that you want to do.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey everybody, welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Jonathan Twombly. How are you doing today, Jonathan?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
Awesome. Did I pronounce your name right? Just want to
double check. You did. Yeah. Okay. You didn't even, I was, as you got to it, I was thinking like, okay, is he going to get it right or not?
Yeah. But, nice. I usually ask, but I forgot to ask before we started. So yeah, I appreciate you being here today. So Jonathan is a president of Two Bridges Asset Management, a syndication firm based in Brooklyn, New York. He's also the founder and leader of the multifamily educational platform, Multifamily Launchpad. So Jonathan, again, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. Could you tell the listeners just a little bit more about your background and how you got started in real estate?
Yeah. So I was actually a lawyer for many years here in New York and in Boston and in London. And kind of after, I did it for 12 years, but after about 3 years, I'd had enough and I was kind of looking for my exit. And then my exit kind of got handed to me in 2011 when the work just dried up kind of, after the financial crisis, and the firm let me go. And I was at that point just didn't have any interest in trying to find another law job. I just had no desire to do it. I'd been doing a lot of networking in the real estate space. And, to make a long story short, I kind of met up with somebody who said, "Hey, I'm starting a real estate investment business. Would you like to join me?" And when my due diligence on her consisted of trotting her around a bunch of my friends to get their take on what she was saying. And the result of that was, "Hey, if you decide to partner up with her, we'll give you money to invest." So we joined forces and we kind of banged our heads against the wall for a couple of years looking at deals in Louisiana. And it was a tough time to be buying deals. I mean, the prices were a whole lot better than they are now, but the banks were just scared. And so we had deals under contract that we had all the equity lined up and the banks backed out, and it was pretty, and also they were not comfortable with Louisiana as a place to invest. And, so that we had went into trouble that way. So we decided to break up the firm after a couple of attempts, and I went into business with one of my investors and formed Two Bridges and changed the focus to the Carolinas. Once I did that, I mean, kind of pretty rapidly got moving, built up a portfolio of about 400 units. And then the prices just started getting out of control. And this was even a few years ago. I mean, now I can't believe where they are now, but even 4 or 5 years ago, I thought the market had kind of lost its bearings. And so we wound up getting an offer that we couldn't refuse on those properties and sold everything and basically doubled our investors' money in a couple of years. And since then, I've been looking at deals, but kind of changing my focus, trying to zig where other people are zagging. I don't really like investing where everybody else is investing, because I think that you basically, the dynamic is that you can turn a safe investment into an unsafe investment if everybody does it. So by bidding up the price to where it's no longer a good risk adjusted return. So those markets no longer are very attractive to me, at least for buying existing product. So I'm now looking at the Northeast more and, just trying to branching out into other things too, as well as some cannabis related deals. So just trying to, do what other people are not doing rather than following the crowd.
Nice. That's awesome. So I'd love to backtrack just a little bit and get kind of the details of, when you were first starting out. So the partner that you kind of connected with and you were looking at deals in Louisiana, did you close on anything, or was it just didn't work?
We did it. We took those deals right up to closing right up to closing, and the banks backed out at the last minute and we couldn't arrange for new financing. So, Yeah.
And this was really, back in 2011 or
this 12? Was 2012 when this was going on. So yeah, it was a tough experience because we were out, you know, all of our due diligence costs, and we got our deposits back because, you know, in those days it was still possible to get a financing contingency. So we were still in our financing period, but you know, we got our deposits back, but we had the loan fees. You know, the bank spent all the money that we had on deposit with them before telling us that they didn't want to do the deal. And the, you know, so, and we had all of our costs for, you know, for travel and all the due diligence, and you know, we'd hired due diligence experts to work with us because we wanted to make sure that we were doing it right. So all those costs we just had to eat. So it was a bad experience, especially when, you know, like this was my full-time job and I was living out of savings at the time. So, you know, this was supposed to be the big payday that was the result for all the work. And not only did we not get paid, but we had to eat all these costs. So it was a pretty tough experience to go through.
Oh, wow. So yeah, that makes sense. So then what changed as you sort of, you know, it sounds like you decided to pivot, you got into a new market in the Carolinas. Did you also change the debt structure there as far as sourcing the debt, or was it just the market that changed for you?
I mean, the market was different. And I think given another year or so of recovery, the banks had more appetite for deals. But I think when I've talked with other lenders about this experience, they've said this is ridiculous. They just had, you know, they just decided not to do the deal for some reason without any real good reason not to. They just got scared. And we don't know why. I mean, it's the kind of deal that now they would be falling all over themselves to lend on. But it's at the time they just thought, oh, C-class property in Louisiana. I don't know. You know, they just got very anxious and backed out.
So. Oh, well. Was it a community bank or agency?
No. It was agency.
Oh,
agency
it was. Debt. Okay.
Yeah. And wow. When they sent us this report, right, or the reasons why they were backing out, and it was full of crazy stuff. Like one of the reasons was it's next to a golf course and we found a broken window with a golf ball.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, really, that was in the report. The other one was the breezeways were dirty. And we were like, yeah, well, we plan on power washing them. That's, you know, and then,
yeah.
And then the final one was, well, there are 10 down units. And we're like, well, yeah, we know that's the value add. We're going to go, we're getting a 100 unit deal for the price of 90. It was 90, you know, it met their occupancy requirements because it was 100% full for every available unit. Right. So it wasn't an issue of not meeting the occupancy requirements. It was, they just were trying to string together, you know, reasons why not to do the deal. And frankly, at the price we were paying, even at 90%, we could have done nothing and made money on that deal because we were buying it at like a 9 or a 10 cap. And, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like a great deal. I mean, you've
got
a
good deal.
Every rentable unit you've got occupied, and then you've got the opportunity to add value to the down units. I mean, that sounds like a home run right there.
Yeah, it would have cost us like all of like $60,000 to bring those units online. We weren't going to do anything to the exteriors, just bring the down units back. And we didn't even because we didn't really know what we were doing. We didn't even know how to underwrite the value add component of it at the time. We just underwrote the buy and hold aspect of it. And on that, I remember having to keep on revising before I sent it out to my investors. I was like, they're not going to believe this. Like, so I kept on making it more and more and more conservative to make it believable, because the returns that we were projecting were like, can this be possible? You know? And so, but it just, I wish we'd bought the deal. You know, we probably could have doubled or tripled our money on that deal without doing anything to the property. So
yeah. Wow. That's amazing. So let's talk about when things got rolling. So you decided to pivot. You mentioned that you found a new partner, one of your investors, and you decided to partner and move into the Carolinas. I guess my first question is, how did you decide who to partner with, and kind of how you navigated who was good at what and splitting up the duties and all that fun stuff?
I can short circuit all of that. He was completely passive. He was not interested in being involved. It was just a financial backer.
It
was actually his idea. You know, he's an old friend of mine. And when we had, you know, after the first business didn't work out, we went out to dinner and I was like, God, I don't know what to do. I think I'm going to have to go back to practicing law. And he was like, not so fast. Like, how about we join up? So that was, you know, how I was able to start that company. It was basically taking venture capital essentially from him to start the business, because I got like runway to pay myself while I was building the business. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, so he was all in at that point. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what did that first deal look like in the Carolinas? What was the first one that you guys did together?
So the first one that we got done was 102 units
awesome.
In Spartanburg, South Carolina. Okay. So
it's a great market.
Yeah, so I never went through that. I mean, a lot of people go through this path of fix and flips, and they start buying quads, you know, duplexes and quads and stuff. And I never did that. I just sort of jumped into these big properties, even with my first partner. You know, it's funny, when we first kind of connected, I just had assumed, because we were here in Brooklyn, that what she meant by real estate investing was like buying brownstones in Brooklyn and rehabbing them. That was just my assumption. Then when we got together and started talking about it, in like, she's like, no, we're going to buy 100 unit deals in Texas and Louisiana and like get the money from investors. And I was like, really? Like, I didn't even know that was possible. So I kind of jumped in as a syndicator from day one without ever having gone through the kind of normal progression that people do. However, like, I'm now actually thinking of going back to like what people started out with, just because, I mean, for a variety of reasons, we could talk about it, but, you know, I kind of skipped that whole initial phase that most people go through.
Did you have a mentor or anything that kind of helped you, you know, learn how to analyze those deals or even wrap your head around 100 units when you weren't thinking about it before?
I went, you know, she had gone to some guru to learn how to, I mean, her background was that she and her husband actually owned a bunch of multifamily property, or her husband did. And then, but for just for himself, and, you know, he was wealthy and he bought property. Then he bought a deal that needed a complete gut rehab. And he said to her, like, okay, you do it. And she was like, I don't know how to do it. So she signed up for like a guru program. So then when we got together, then she decided as a result of that, hey, I want to build a business out of this. I don't want to just be dependent on my husband. So she had all of those materials, which I went through. And I have to say, like, they were good about the overview of how the process works. They were crap about underwriting and didn't really. So basically I had to sort of figure out underwriting on my own and just kind of like work through it and work out how to do it by analyzing, you know, broker packages and analyzing operating statements. And I did have, I mean, long before that, I had spent one semester in business school and did take finance in business school, and I had underwritten companies. So I had kind of like an idea of how it was supposed to work, although it was, you know, it was like 10 years before that. And I had mostly forgotten it, but I guess I had some kind of like residual memory about the general idea of how you're supposed to underwrite something. Right. So, yeah.
Nice. That's awesome. So it seems like you did really well. I mean, the first deal was 102 units and you said you built up around 400 shortly after that. It sounds like you've sold most of that off at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, we sold everything. So kind of coming into 2019, you know, there were some kind of dark clouds on the horizon economics wise. And I was, and at the same time, so kind of two things were going through my mind. One was I kept on getting offers on the properties that were kind of crazy. And then the second was that we were honestly having collections problems at a couple of properties. And I was thinking, like, if we're having these collections problems now when the economy is strong, what on earth is this going to look like if there's a recession? Because these were like C properties, you know, like your most vulnerable tenants, the people who are most likely to lose their jobs, you know, who have no savings to fall back on. And I was like, this is not, I don't really want to stick around to find out what this looks like when there's a recession. So the combination of those two things, we were getting people offering us crazy amounts of money for these properties, and, you know, us being like, you know, a couple of these properties aren't that great, was like, okay, make it somebody else's problem and make my investors happy at the same time. So we sold them. I mean, like I said, if you'd invested in all four, you would have doubled your money. The worst one that we did, we had one real dog of the portfolio, just sort of everything that you could imagine went wrong with the property. And even on that property, the investors made 50% on their money and they were very happy. So it all turned out well. But honestly, you know, the market was what really turned those into successes. It wasn't our, you know, my brilliance at being an operator. It was just, it's easy to invest and make money when the market is rising. So that's, you know, and I think a lot of people out there who have been making a lot of money recently are just in there at the right time. certainly, you know, if honestly, like we were in there at the right time too. We bought low, we sold high, you know, it's sort of, it's hard to not make money under those circumstances.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about your strategy moving forward. I mean, you touched on it a little bit, but so it seems like you've sold off everything in the Carolinas. What markets do you like these days? And also, what types of assets? Are you moving into smaller stuff like you kind of hinted at?
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at all sorts of stuff, just trying to find deals that make sense. And so one thing I've been looking at is smaller properties, you know, the kind of 30, 40 unit deals, just to find stuff where, you know, again, originally the idea of like the 100 unit deal was, hey, you're buying these assets sub 10 million, institutional capital is not interested in them. They're too big for most small investors. So there's value that you can unlock there because the prices have gone up so much. Basically where we are now is these 30 unit deals now cost what the 100 unit deals cost 5-6 years ago. So the 100 unit deals are all now up over $10 million. They're into that institutional level and that family office level. And it's like you now, it just compresses cap rates even more. So they're, you know, but those groups are not interested in this, these 30, 40 unit deals. So that's one thing, just to try to find a little more meat on the bone. The other thing is that real estate has all investing, and real estate is not immune to this. There's a huge herd mentality around real estate. And everybody rushes into the same markets, you know, and oftentimes it starts out being like, there's a reason for it. Well, the demographics are really good here. And like, for instance, South Carolina, when I started, had the combination of great demographics and high cap rates, right? And part of that was because everybody was focused on Texas and nobody was paying attention to what was going on in the Carolinas. Now, eventually they figured out the Carolinas and then everybody rushed in. And the demographics are still great, but the cap rates are low and, you know, the value is gone. So, you know, the states, you know, the typical sort of investor, when you're hearing everybody on podcasts and stuff, they all pretty much say the same thing. Like, oh, we look for markets where there's, you know, growing population and landlord friendly and sort of like there's a list of things that they say. So basically they're all looking at the same markets, right? And when they're all looking at the same markets, they drive the prices up and the cap rates down and they make it harder for themselves to make money. My thinking is that, well, look, there's a whole lot left to this country that doesn't fit that description, where tens of millions of people live and they pay rent. And there may be a little bit more hassle involved in owning the properties, but places like upstate New York, which demographically is not great at all. And obviously there's some hair attached to operating in New York State. The real hair in New York is in New York City, and people tend to then project that onto the rest of the state.
True. Yeah.
So if you're operating upstate New York, it's more or less like operating everywhere else as a, you know, as an operator or in the quote unquote landlord friendly states. But you're, because nobody's out there talking about like how great upstate New York is all the time, it means that there's value left. But there are markets up there that are affluent markets with really stable populations where, because the demographics are not off the charts spectacular, there's no new supply coming on. And you have a great supply-demand balance there because stuff is still aging out, right? Rental properties are aging out and nothing new is getting built. So you have some good kind of supply demand forces at work. So I've been looking for deals up there. Also, I mean, I haven't really dug in yet, but one of the markets I'm attracted to is certain markets in Pennsylvania, where again, Pennsylvania has got the same sort of bad rap as New York, maybe not as bad a rap as New York, but it has, nobody's out there running around talking about how great Pennsylvania is. But the thing is, there's actually markets in Pennsylvania that have really solid population growth and have some attractive features about them. And so they're, you know, in this kind of market, you just have to get more creative and go where other people are not going. And I mean, that doesn't mean it's easy in those markets either. I mean, I'm still seeing stuff that in upstate New York that's really overpriced. You know, there's a lot of competition for it, but it's not, you know, unrealistic owners or the stuff that's not selling is not selling because the sellers are holding out for prices that they just aren't going to get for these properties, but, you know, because they're being influenced by what they're seeing all over the place. But there's definitely more opportunity. I'd rather be buying, you know, you know, if I'm going to be buying C-class deals, I'd rather be buying them at a six cap in upstate New York than at a, like, you know, a 3.5 or 4 cap in the South. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do these days, is just zig a little bit. And the other thing too, is that, you know, I definitely, you know, still do syndications, but I also feel like the real value is in owning it yourself. I mean, you can scale more with other people's money, but at the end of the day, I mean, I'd really rather capture the returns for myself. So doing smaller deals allows me to do that, and without having to do syndications. And so kind of, I think there is an opportunity, I think, for people, if you have a little bit of capital, to do small deals and kind of slowly build your net worth and build into doing bigger deals. And the thing about owning them yourselves, like when you're doing a syndication, you've got to sell and return the investor's money at some point.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say
that. But the real value is not to you, is not holding the deal for 5 years and selling it and doing another deal. The real value is 30 years from now, when you've got a property that's free and clear, or your debt service is just minimal on it, and it's just cash flowing like crazy, and you don't really have to do anything to the property, and your day-to-day is like playing golf or sailing or whatever it is that you want to do. Like that's rather than running like a business with hundreds and hundreds of investors that you have to be managed, right?
So absolutely.
I view syndication as kind of a means to an end. It's to get you to the point where you have your own capital so that you no longer need to do syndications. You know, unless your desire is to build like a huge fund and that's kind of floats your boat, and you want to get on, like, be one of those guys who says, I've got 10,000 units. Like, okay, if that's going to make you happy, that's great. But if you want to have like a lifestyle where at some point you're like, hey, I'm good, I don't have to do anything, I don't have to work. You know, since so many people are like talking, they want to go into real estate because I don't want to work hard. Well, if you're going to go do a syndication business forever, you're going to be working hard the rest of your life. So if that's your goal, you should really rethink the whole syndication model, or at least think about what, like how long you want to do it and what your goal for it is. But I've changed my perspective on it from being like syndication being the goal to syndication being the means to an end. And the end being not having to do syndications anymore and just being one of those guys who's just collecting checks and not working hard. So
yeah, no, I love that. I think that's one of the reasons why I still talk about joint ventures, is because, you know, when you have 30 investors in a syndication, no one's ever going to be on the same page of when it's time to sell and things like that. But if you can get two or three people in a deal who are happy with holding it long term and maybe passing it on to their kids one day, you can hold it for 30 years and everybody's happy. So I think there's something to be said for that, for sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually mentioned that, because that is really something I've been thinking a lot of recently. Like, rather than doing syndications and having like 50 or 100 people in a deal, I'd rather just have like 10 guys that I like, that we enjoy spending time together, and I think they're decent people, and just saying to them like, hey, here's another, let's go buy another 20, 25 units here and just build our, you know, I'll run the thing so you guys don't have to deal with it, but I'm not trying to like have a 10,000 unit portfolio and like, you know, pat myself on the back and compare units, you know, to other people. Like just want to invest and have a good life. So that's, you know, if I had 10 guys who were just like, hey, Jonathan, we trust you, we'll invest in everything, every deal you put in front of us, we'll put money into, that would be the dream, actually, and not have to deal with raising money in the syndication and all that kind of stuff. So
it's that time of the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about your real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So Jonathan, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
So the best deal that I did was a deal called Village Park Apartments, which was, it's in Simpsonville, South Carolina. And that deal, it was 132 units, you know, C property, but in a really good market. It was like a C property and like a B-plus market, and one of the kind of like cities outside of Greenville, South Carolina, that's just really affluent and growing. And it was a nice property because it was also really walkable. And unlike a lot of those suburban multifamilies down south, you could walk to downtown in 5 minutes, just down a nice street. And then there were restaurants and things to go to and a good school district. So it was really like set up for success. And only one, the construction company that built it still owned it 35 years later when we bought it. And so it had not, you know, had not seen a lot of churning from owners and stuff. And the rents basically were just really low on the property. And we did a little bit of like very light kind of cosmetic value add to it. And it just performed like crazy. I mean, we were hitting our preferred return in the second quarter every year. And, you know, and it just really, really performed well. And the secret to that deal, honestly, was I just bought it for the right price. We bought it. You just never hear people talking about this anymore because it's impossible. But when I got into the business, the mantra was, you make your money on the buy. You make your money when you buy the deal. You don't make your money like you don't buy operating it better. You don't make your money by like, even if you're doing a value add, the key is how much you pay for the property in the first place. Not like how much you think it's going to be worth later or how much rent increases you think you're going to get or whatever. It's like, if you buy it well, you'll do well. If you don't buy it well, you won't do well. And so, and we just really kind of stole the deal, even though at the time I didn't know that when I bought it, like I didn't think, oh, I'm stealing this deal. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I'm paying this much for this property. But in retrospect, we really stole it. And a big piece of it was the utilities. And the way that worked out was the previous owner had been allowing all of their tenants, every single apartment had its own spigot outside. And the previous owner had allowed the tenants to wash their cars with those spigots. So their water bills were enormous. And then right before they sold it, they capped all the spigots. So the water bills, and basically the timing of it was, they didn't do it early enough to allow that to be reflected in the financials. The financials showed really high utilities. And then as we took it over, the utility bills dropped because the tenants were not allowed to wash their cars anymore. So that was a big piece of it. And then, like I said, the rents were low because they'd owned it for a really long time. They weren't aggressive about pushing rents. They actually had the same property manager for 35 years who lived on the property. She was friends with all the tenants. She wasn't raising rents on them. Like it just, you know, there was just a lot of unlocked value in the property. And the company that owned it, they sold it because they wanted to free up capital to build new, you know, they saw kind of what was coming and they were a construction company. So that was their business. They were looking at this as, hey, our basis in this, we're like fully depreciated. Our basis is out of here. We're going to make $5 million on this deal and we're going to turn around and put that money into new construction. But that turned out to be just a fantastic cash flowing deal. So yeah, that was a great deal.
How did you find that deal? Was it through a broker relationship or did you source it yourself?
No, that was brought to me off market by a broker.
Okay.
So the seller had decided not to formally list it, but had just reached out to a couple of brokers and said, bring us buyers. So we had to kind of do the due diligence on it pretty quickly and make an offer pretty quickly. And I actually made an offer on it before I even saw it. I just got on Google and looked it over on Google and put in an LOI on that basis. And then went down to, you know, just, it was, had to happen fast. But then when I went down, I was like, oh, this is actually, you know, looks pretty good. So
yeah, nice. That's awesome. And what would you say is the worst deal that you've done?
Oh God, the worst deal was the first one I did, which was the Village Park Apartments. And again, it's the opposite story. It's again, you make your money on the buy or not. That deal, I didn't think I was overpaying for, but I did. And so part of it was my fault and part of it was the property manager's fault subsequent to that. But what happened with that deal, and some of it was out of everybody's control, but the stuff that was, so my, the thing that was my fault was probably overpaying for it, even though, you know, we bought it for 40 a door. So it didn't really seem like it was that we were overpaying for it, but in the general mix of things, we probably did. The property had, you know, this is also something that you learn over time, that we bought there are good flippers and there are bad flippers, right? Now we bought deals and tried to buy another deal from a very good flipping company and they did things right. They like really did their construction well. They put in good tenants. They left a little meat on the bone when they sold it. You know, buying from those guys is great if you have a long-term hold strategy. There's also people who just go in there and they put bodies in and to try to make it look filled up. And the people that they put in there are not qualified. So we basically bought a building with a bad tenant base. And, but then, so that, but that only should have been a problem for like a year, right? Because you cycle through your tenants. The problem then became that the management company that I hired, the first management company I hired on this property, they screwed up and they, and it took us a, it took us like 2 years to figure this out, but they use a vendor for tenant qualification and they, the vendor put in the wrong qualifications for tenants. So they, rather than doing it for market rate, which is where they have to have, you know, 3x the rent in salary to rent, they put it in for subsidized, which is 2x the rent. So the tenants kept on defaulting and we had this bad eviction problem. We just kept on evicting and we're like, hey, we're bringing in new tenants. Why are we evicting the new tenants now? Because they should not, they're supposed to be better quality. And the management company is like, oh yeah, you know, these are all our new tenants. You know, they've been vetted. They've been, you know, they passed the criteria. And it literally took, it was like 2 years before anybody thought to look at what criteria the vendor was using. Then what happened was they told the vendor, you're using the wrong criteria. And the vendor said, okay, we'll fix it. And then the vendor went, instead of fixing it, they went and applied the wrong criteria to all of our properties. So suddenly the good performing properties started, you know, suddenly we're getting an uptick in delinquency there too. Like, what the hell is going on? Because they screwed it up. So that was kind of like main problem number one at that property. It just built up all this bad debt. And it's very hard to like get out from under that once you build up bad debt. And then we started having stuff that was just beyond anybody's control. Like we had two major fires in a month at the property, you know, probably something like tenants leaving the stove on or, you know, and leaving the apartment or something like that. But we lost an entire building in one fire. We lost three or four units in another fire. It was just a horrendous experience to go through. So that property, just, I think everybody's going to have one of these in their portfolio, the property where just nothing goes right. And, but, you know, we sold it, we made money because everybody wants multifamily. So,
yeah. What's the number one thing that you learned from that? Is there one takeaway that you now has helped you kind of analyze deals moving forward?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm like became much more conservative in my underwriting as a result of that. And one of the things I became conservative, I mean, I've really started deviating away from standard underwriting principles because I don't think that they're very good in reflecting what the actual operations of buildings are going to be. And one of the ways in which that's true is that, you know, you're all focused on NOI and you're underwriting based on NOI, but you've got a lot of expense that falls below the NOI line that's going to impact the cash that you actually put in your pocket. And if you're not underwriting a serious amount of cap, especially if you're buying older properties, if you're not underwriting a bunch of CapEx like every year, you're going to overpay for the property, even though, you know, you're supposed to be, you know, valuing it on an NOI cap rate basis. And, you know, people often don't even put CapEx into their underwriting at all. So, but the reality of the matter, if you want to talk about like cash in your pocket, if you're not accounting for CapEx, then like the cash is not going into your pocket. So the problem becomes now though that it's made it very difficult for me to buy deals because I put in a CapEx allowance into these properties and that makes it even harder, you know, to find deals that actually make sense and provide the return that you want because you're adding additional expense to the property that's not captured in your OpEx, right? So it makes it more conservative and in a market like this where it's hard to buy deals if you're conservative. I mean, if you're, you know, everybody says they're conservative, but they're actually not because they're buying deals right now. So if you're really conservative, it becomes really hard to actually buy stuff. So but that's the lesson I learned from that deal. We just had so much unanticipated CapEx pop up on that deal just because it was old and water mains going and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, the other lesson would be have a lot of reserves. You got to raise a lot of reserves for these older properties. That's another way to skin it, but that's also going to impact your returns, right? Because you're going to have to raise extra money now for those CapEx issues. And a lot of them a lot of these CapEx issues, like if you go and you do a big rehab on a property, you will fix a lot of stuff that's wrong with the property and then you won't have to deal with it. But nobody is going in when they're doing a major rehab and like digging up all of the water mains and replacing them, right? You know, stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff that really whacked us on these properties, where we had like the water main break of the month club for a while and $10,000 every time, right? And that happens two, three times a year. I mean, that's really making it hard to pay your investors your preferred returns when you've got $30,000 of CapEx that you didn't expect, right? So the lesson is account for that, but also raise reserves when you're doing a syndication to make sure that you've got the money in the bank to pay for it. And one of the differences too, like with that, the deal that went really well, we actually overraised money, not intentionally. We sort of wound up overraising a little bit of money on that deal. So we had a reserve fund and we were just able to kind of like use that as our own internal revolving bank fund to fund unexpected CapEx. So it meant that we were not having any trouble meeting the prefs. And we, even on that deal was so good, it didn't matter. Like we could have paid all the CapEx out of cash and still hit the preferred return with room to spare. But we also had a decent reserve fund on that property, and that made it even easier. So again, that's like a huge, you got to raise extra money for reserves if you're doing older properties, for sure.
Yeah, that's great advice. Awesome. Well, Jonathan, we're just about out of time here, but one final question. Where can passive investors go to connect with you and maybe even invest in your deals?
Yeah, so they should come to Two Bridges Management. So the URL is, it's Two Bridges spelled out in MGMT for management.com. It might be easier just to Google Two Bridges Asset Management and we'll pop right up.
Okay, awesome. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate all your insights and yeah, have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.